Welcome to Beyond the Pulpit, exploring the life and ministry of Walnut Creek Church downtown. This podcast is a ministry of the pastors of Walnut Creek downtown for our members and regular attenders. To learn more, please visit walnutcreekchurch.org/downtown or join us on Sunday mornings at 8, 9:15, or 10:45 a.m. at 323 East Locust Street in downtown Des Moines.
Well, all right. Welcome to Beyond the Pulpit. My name is Derek Wadley, and I'm joined here by Luke Hookie. Say hi, Luke.
Hey, guys.
And Dan Rood is actually out of town in upstate New York doing some baseball stuff with his kids this week. So we actually had to call in two ringers to take his spot. We're joined by Bob Joy, pastor at Walnut Creek downtown, leader of our care ministry. Say hi, Bob.
Hey, Derek.
And we're joined by Eric Semjanow, pastoral resident, director of DMAC Campus Fellowship. Say hi, Eric.
Hey, guys.
We're actually not here to talk about the care team. We're not here to talk about the pastoral residency or DMAC. We're here to talk about the Southern Baptist Convention annual meeting, which was last week in majestic Indianapolis, Indiana.
Majestic.
The Paris of the Midwest, might say.
Yes. Who says that?
The city designers, based on how they designed it and all their little monuments, they just built a giant Eiffel Tower outside the convention center.
They're building a statue to Caitlin Clark, too.
I think that was the
100-foot poster on the building.
That's right. But yeah, so the four of us were actually at the SBC annual meeting last week. And I think that the first question that might be coming to a lot of people's mind is, why in the world were you guys at the Southern Baptist Convention annual? Why did we go to that?
Well, we drew the short end of the stick, I think is what it was. We drew straws, right? And we just, got forced to go.
That's right. We love it.
We have nothing else.
Okay, I love it.
Bob does.
Bob loves it.
No, we went to the SBC annual meeting because we are a part of the Southern Baptist denomination. As you might know, we remember that we joined the SBC, I believe, in the summer of 2020. And so for the last 4 years or so, we have been going to the annual meetings to have our voice heard, to be a part of the process in voting in amendments and resolutions and just participating in the denomination that we now belong to.
Yeah. Yep. And so that was a little bit of a process to decide how we're doing that. We were associated with the Great Commission Association of Churches. And for just a variety of reasons, Great Commission was kind of done as an association. And we decided we were going to kind of look into what we were going to do. And Bob and Luke, you were actually a part of that group that went and did the search. So what was that process like for you guys? And kind of why did we land with the Southern Baptists?
Yeah, there are a handful of us that checked into various other possible denominations. There was kind of four areas of criteria we were looking for. We were looking for doctrine, of course, that we would be consistent on that, mission and methodology, but how they go about it, relationships, what other churches, SBC churches are in the area, and then lastly is resources, what could be provided to us, and then what would we be giving our money toward?
Yeah, that's right.
So those are kind of the four criteria that we were looking for.
Yep. Great. Yeah.
And we decided, as we went through that process, we looked at a number of denominations, and the SBC seemed to really line up with what we were looking for and match that criteria. And I think, even particularly relationships, there's a lot more churches, SBC churches in the area. Some of the denominations we were looking at, there weren't other churches within a few hours of us.
So
we wanted to be able to partner more, and this allows us even to have more overlap and partnership with other churches in the Des Moines area, which is exciting.
And locally, we're part of the Baptist Convention of Iowa.
Yep.
And that is, I think, been really the sweet spot and where we've built a lot of the really excellent relationships with some of the churches, like younger churches that are just getting going. And it really seems like the SBC, the way that we have historically thought about planting churches and sending missionaries, the resources and the alignment there has been excellent. Yeah. And so,
maybe sometime we can get into that later with pastoral resident Eric Semjanow, but
maybe
not today.
Maybe. Yeah. No, that's a different conversation. That is a different conversation. There's going to be enough rabbit trails here, I'm sure. All right. So we went to this meeting, and this meeting is not like a conference. So when I talked to a lot of people and said, yeah, I'm going to Indy for the SBC meeting, they'd be like, oh yeah, it's like a conference, right? And I was like, no.
not at all.
People had in their mind was like a gospel coalition, or if you remember Faith Walkers, or something where it's like lots of music and then messages and breakout sessions. And it's like, it's not that at all.
Was some music and there was some message. There were some messages.
There's a little bit.
That's not the bulk of it.
But that was not the lion's share of what we were
doing.
That's
not the thrust of why we're there or what's going on.
It is my mind. Yeah.
And so, you know, Bob, you actually, in a past life, come from a more kind of really like a business oriented type of world. And so this type of meeting was kind of right up your alley. Whenever we go, Bob is like the first up. He's ready to go. He wants to be first in the doors, wants to leave as late as possible. He loves the business of it all. And so, Bob, can you kind of explain to us what it is that we're doing at these meetings so I can make sure that I've understood what I've done the last 3 years?
Yeah. We all have our things we geek out on, guys. And God help me, this is one of them. Combination of having done business meetings for 20 years and conventions and things like that, and then raised in political world where all sorts of political conventions, the whole idea of resolutions and amendments and call to questions and those things I really just kind of like. So, yeah, what this is about is you get 10,000 plus messengers from I don't know how many different congregations across the country that come together and decide, well, what do we want to be known for? What do we want to support? What do we not want to support? And there's dozens and dozens of resolutions or, you know, proposals put forth to the group that can be addressed or not be addressed. And then you have all the different commissions and the committees that report out on their work for the year. And the body of messengers there get to decide, do we like what you did or we don't like what you did? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can really get in the weeds. Like, I want to do an amendment, then I want to do an amendment to the amendment, and then I'm tired of talking, so we're going to call the question. And yeah, it's kind of fun. Sometimes it gets a little deep, but
yeah,
I like it.
Sometimes you're trying to figure out exactly what are we amending?
What are we voting on?
Are we voting on right now?
Right. Oh, we're only talking about the amendment to the amendment of the original amendment.
Including the president. He doesn't even know what's going on.
That's right.
So that's why his parliamentarians can be behind him the whole time, you know, telling him which way you should go.
It's quite a process. It's pretty remarkable how well it works, given you have 10,000 people who are voting on these things. It's well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very well done. And so, Bob, you come from a world where you love it. You geek out on
it. I do.
And then, Eric, you've never been to anything like this
before. Nothing.
And so what's your reaction as somebody who's never been in this type of setting?
Yeah.
He loves it, too.
Big fan.
Bob, he's profession.
Right. Yes. I'm going to be a parliamentarian now. No.
It's rules, baby. Rules.
The experience, I think that's the main reason I went, was just to have the eye-opening. I knew it was like a spectacle, but I think just showing up and seeing about 11,000 people, first off, that was just wild.
Because there's 10,000 registered
messengers,
which are the voters, delegates, plus all the other people who are there too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Crazy. All the booths and everything, that's normal for conferences and stuff. But I mean, imagining basically running a business meeting with that many voices in the room. And things move pretty slow. But
don't say.
I mean, it was a cool thing. Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of that.
The Southern draw.
Southern Brothers and the draw. Yeah.
It's going to have to be First Baptist Church.
And when you listen to that podcast at 1.5 or 1.25 speed and you go to Southern Baptist, it feels like it's a 0.5 speed.
Yeah, that's right. It's like I love Dr. Albert Mohler more than just about anybody. Yeah. But then hearing him speak in person versus my 2x speed on the podcast is a very different experience.
Although he's still speaks fast.
He does speak fast.
Yeah. Sorry, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess just my whole experience with it was a really cool thing to think how much thought goes into landing where all these churches, like how much goes into having actual unity across a whole, you know, thousands of churches. That's oh, this is what it takes in order to actually be on the same page and stand together. And even there, it's like there's a lot of hot debate. From everything I've heard, this was the mild version of the SBC convention compared to the past couple years. So,
Bob, Derek, we've been to four.
Yeah.
This is our fourth.
This is my third.
This is my third. This is your fourth. You went to Nashville 4 years ago,
right?
Yeah,
it was Dan and Darren and I. And yeah, this was by far the most tame of all the conventions. So,
is that a good thing?
I think so, I guess. I don't know how to answer that question. I think I could argue both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I think given what, as we'll get into it here, what was voted on and whatnot, I think that was probably a pretty decent thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Bob, I'd be curious what your perspective is. I feel like I'd go both ways on that, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, so for the listener, Bob silently shrugged his shoulders.
It's nice to have a little spice. Good to have a little spice.
Yeah. So what you're not seeing here.
I will say
here,
from that perspective, it is just a little bit boring.
Right. See, there
previous
you go.
Year, day, I mean, yeah. Previous years, you're like, talking out of turn. And it was, I mean, at some points, probably rightfully people were corrected, but at least it shook things up. I'm like talking to Eric. This is so different from previous years.
Yeah.
Like it was way more chill.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is because much of what we were voting on, though there's some excitement and a little bit of buzz, it was pretty chill.
Pretty straightforward business. Yeah. I think that a lot of the issues that came up, this was the third year in a row that some of it had come up.
Right,
and so like
people were
the excitement was kind of lower. And I think that if you trace the kind of even just the attendance of messengers, 3 years ago was in Anaheim, California, which I know when you think Southern Baptists, you think Anaheim,
Disneyland.
That's right.
So Southern California.
But Disneyland, I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Ooh, but then, yeah, walked right by it.
Yeah, every day.
Oh, yeah,
I watched all those poor people going in,
and then the parents dragging their children out of the day.
You're gonna have fun.
This is gonna be fun.
I fell in my soul. I was like, I'm so thankful. That's not me.
So happy right now. The happiest place on earth is the other side of the gate. but
that's a t-shirt.
Yeah, but the thing is, Anaheim was the home of Rick Warren and Saddleback Church, and that's kind of, we'll get into this a little bit here, but that's kind of there. And that was a pretty low attended convention, because A, it's pretty far away from most Southern Baptists, and B, it's so expensive.
Yeah.
It's so expensive just to get around. But just to get there was really expensive.
Gas, like six something a gallon.
Gas was like six something a gallon. The flight, I mean, I think we got a good deal on our flights, but like it's still expensive. And then last year was in New Orleans, Louisiana.
New Orleans.
Which, I'm not even going to get into my feelings about New Orleans.
Wow. Hot and humid.
Great place to visit. It's a great place. Anyway, go ahead.
Good food.
Great food.
Yeah, that's true.
Good food.
Great food. But I don't know. I felt like I needed to change my shirt three or four times.
Yeah. It's 7:30 in the morning, convention center. And it was like walking through like just water, like just you're drenched by the time you get in and you walk into the convention center, it's freezing cold.
Your shirt just turns into an icicle.
Yeah. Like,
but we appreciate the privilege of representing our congregation.
Amen.
We do.
Regardless of circumstance.
Way to bring it back, Bob.
There we go. What you can't see is that we have cameras. This time we're piloting and trying to figure out what it looks like to turn this into a video podcast. And there's been a lot of little looks like, hey, you guys, you young bucks better get your act together. I got better things to do than sit here and moderate you guys. We might show you what that's about. And if you hear any other background noises, we've got producer JT in the background.
Oh, yes.
Say hi, JT.
What's up?
All right. So
I hear him, but
I don't know if you heard him or not, but Josh Thomas is here. All right. Well, let's get into the actual thick of it now that we've unpacked it. So there are kind of three big things that have kind of filled the headlines since the meeting. One has kind of been a perpetual headline for probably the four or five years now in the SBC, and that's related to the sex abuse task force.
Mm-hmm.
And the task force, it's a very complicated thing. There's a lot of information out there. Some of it's helpful and accurate. Some of it's unhelpful and inaccurate. Some of it's unhelpful and accurate. And so it's a matter of trying to find, you know, kind of that information. And there's been a lot of even just posturing that has happened as a part of how it's gone. And so it's really easy to be a non-involved talking head on social media and say the SBC is just rampant with all sorts of issues and things. But then if you read the reports, it's like, yeah, sex abuse in any situation is a problem. It's horrible. It ought to be condemned in the strongest possible terms. And my experience so far with the SBC is that they have actually done a pretty good job
responding
to it. The amount of resources and people that have volunteered their time and money that's been put into this has been really good. And so the Sex Abuse Task Force has kind of wrapped up its role at this point. And they've created a series of recommendations that they're passing to the SBC Executive Committee, which is kind of like the administrative branch of the convention that operates the rest of the year when the meeting isn't happening. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that we really have a whole lot more to share on that front. There's recommendations that have been passed, but Bob, Eric.
Well, yeah, the Abuse Reform and Implementation Task Force, ARITF, referred to now as the task force, basically brought three things up in their recommendation one. It said the first was the expansion of a ministry toolkit, which they wanted to make resources available to congregations. And of course, I think everybody's supportive of that. The second thing was the establishment of the Ministry Check website. And there's been a fair amount of controversy over that about who would be on that, what would be included. Correct me, guys, but it seems like they're making it clear that there had to be a conviction or a civil suit found to make it on there. Now, there's maybe like 100 folks they're thinking might be on there, but that's not live yet.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So that was the second thing. But the third thing is the creation of a permanent home for abuse prevention and response. And then it seems like in their second recommendation, they were urging the executive committee to basically complete this work and provide the structure. It seems like the task force thinks they've kind of come to the end of what they can do, and they're, you know, handing it off to the executive committee, was how I recall that.
Yeah. It's a group of volunteers.
On the task force.
They're not getting paid. They poured a lot of time into it. And one of the things that was kind of the most eye-opening to me was that, you know, on the surface, it says there are critics of the task force that have said, oh, they just got like millions and millions of dollars that they just got to spend willy-nilly, and what do they have to show for it? But then they explain the process of how they go about getting the money. And it seemed like it was just a ton of work to get them to like reimburse like a cup of coffee, let alone anything meaningful or significant. I think that the direction it's going is good. We'll have to see next year what the executive committee reports back with in terms of what they plan on doing.
Yep.
The second thing, one of the two main headlines that are coming out has to do with a resolution on IVF. And so the actual resolution that came up this year was called On the Ethical Realities of Reproductive Technologies and the Dignity of the Human Embryo. And so this resolution was written by Albert Mohler and Andrew Walker. And what they were wanting to do was call to the attention of the messengers of the Southern Baptist Convention and members of Southern Baptist churches that there are some real ethical challenges that need to be wrestled with when it comes to reproductive technology, in the same way that we wrestle with them when it comes to abortion. And so do you guys want to speak at all to kind of what you've taken from reading the resolution or speaking with anybody
that? Well, I think one, the resolution passed. I think that's good. I think Al Mohler and Andrew Walker, if you remember, Andrew Walker was here for our conference on sex, gender back in the fall. And so their hope, again, is like to draw attention to the ethical challenges of in vitro fertilization. And we'll remember that we are pro-life, right? Yeah, we believe that every human being is made in the image of God and therefore has dignity, value, and worth. And part of what's happening in the IVF process is that embryos are being made,
fertilized.
Eggs are being fertilized, embryos. In other words, human beings are
created.
Being created, yeah. And so an embryo is a fertilized egg, and therefore it is a human life. And so there are some challenges when it comes to the in vitro fertilization process and the number of eggs that are fertilized and the number of embryos that are then brought into the world. And so they want to draw attention to the reality of these challenges, and just as Christians that we need to think through these, and we need to think through the ethical realities of technologies like reproductive technologies. And oftentimes technology kind of—
It outpaces the ethic.
Yeah. And so I would say this space, Christians, I would say for myself, and I don't know about you guys, but I've been caught a bit off guard.
Yeah,
like it's kind of like as the more I've dug into the IVF world, I'm like, boy, I didn't realize kind of what was going on and what's happening and how you have human beings who are, you know, in freezers just kind of waiting for potentially to be used. Now there's court cases about those embryos being destroyed or put to death. And so we want to uphold life, and we want to protect life. We want to value life, and we need to be really careful and biblical in our approach to reproduction and specifically reproductive technology. So I don't know, Bob, you got—
Well, I mean, you know, we're called to speak the truth in love. And so this is not a heartless resolution. I mean, there's part of it that, you know, specifically says we grieve alongside those, you know, that are wrestling with infertility and struggling to conceive, and we affirm their desire to want to have children. That's so we recognize, and we all know people in this situation. So we don't have a cavalier attitude toward this. And at the same time, we need to recognize what's going on and begin to address it.
So if I could address it, because I think I've had a few conversations after coming back, and this is the subject that's come up in my conversations, which I didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's maybe a misconception about what the conversation was actually about. It seems like the takeaway that a lot of people are having is that IVF equals bad, do not do it, like 100%. But I feel like that's not actually what's being said. What's being said is we need to think more carefully about it. Is that correct?
Right. That's not the language of the resolution.
Correct.
And so the headlines, you get into like the New York Times and Associated Press and all of that, the headline is definitely Southern Baptists condemn and make all people who practice IVF evil. You know, that's like kind of how they read.
Yeah.
And the articles themselves, the few that I've read, don't actually even include any of the language from the resolution. So, which is crazy.
Can I just read this really quick? Here's what the first resolve is. So you have your whereas and you have the resolves, kind of where you stand. And they say, we call Southern Baptists to reaffirm the unconditional value and right to life of every human being, including those in embryonic stage, and to use only only utilize reproductive technologies consistent with that affirmation, especially in the number of embryos generated in the IVF process. And so we want to be I don't know how much people know about the IVF world. I've done some more research just in regards, but there can be sometimes many eggs produced.
Oh, yeah.
And oftentimes there are, because of the process and the expense and all these things. And then you put those eggs on ice, the ones that you don't implant. And so now you have children who are on ice. That's a big problem. And so we want to affirm the desire to have kids. And we want to, again, as Bob said, we want to grieve with those. I mean, there are plenty of couples in our church and people I know personally who are unable to get pregnant, been struggling with that reality. But we also want to be very wise and ethical in how we go about. Not every— just because God values life and children are a gift doesn't mean every way in which children are produced is equally right. And so the further that we get away from the further we get away from reproduction as husband and wife having physical sex together, the more gray area there is.
Yeah.
And so the more questions there become, and we want to do a good job of stewarding you know, these technologies and whatnot. So I think there's more we could probably dig into.
Yeah,
and
but,
the point isn't to get into all that right now, but just to address kind of, hey, this has been coming out.
Yeah.
And so we thought it'd be good to just give a little, little time to it.
Yeah. And like those that have talked to Eric, good job having a conversation with somebody.
Exactly.
Like that's a big deal.
That is big deal.
To actually have a conversation with somebody about it. And so just find us, talk to us, email us, find us at church. Most of us were at the office all the time. Like we're around. You can
read the resolutions online.
Yeah, they're online for all to find.
So there's even an SBC app you can download, and it has all of it on the app. So it's not, if you want the actual language that we have in front of us, it's easy to get to, and we'd be happy to
share it with you.
If you like us too.
Great. Yeah. So there's that one. And then there was an amendment to the Constitution of the Southern Baptist Convention. So there are kind of two governing documents for the Southern Baptist Convention. First is the Baptist Faith and Message. Woofty.
Tongue twister.
And the most recent version is 2000. So that is the convention operates on Baptist Faith and Message, or BF&M 2000. That's where it's at. It's been kind of updated a handful of times since 1845, which is when the SBC was founded. But so there's that. And then there is the constitution and kind of bylaws of the convention itself. So more there's the doctrine side and the business side. Mm. The doctrine side, the BF&M is very clear in terms of what it's trying to communicate. The Constitution can be maybe a little bit ambiguous sometimes, but that's just kind of the nature of constitutions. Our country has experienced that, just as judges across the land have tried to interpret it. But there was an amendment called the Law Amendment that was put forward. And now the Law Amendment
Why is it called the Law Amendment?
Yeah, that's the thing. What law are we amending? It's actually because two years ago, a pastor named Mike Law took the floor at the Anaheim meeting and proposed an amendment to the Constitution to add some additional language. So it's named after Pastor Mike Law, which I got to tell you, some of these Southern Baptist pastors just have the best names.
Yes.
Mike Law. I think Dan Rude is kind of right in there. Not Lou Cookie.
Lou Cookie, yeah.
Lou Cookie. but maybe that works.
Mm.
But anyway, so
you
the law amendment.
Sermon yesterday.
If you weren't at church, you should listen to the message. But the law amendment has to do with who can hold the office and role of pastor.
Mm.
And so the BF&M is very clear that the office and role of pastor is for men as qualified by Scripture.
Yeah, let me just read it real quick. It says, it's two scriptural offices that are we're starting over again here. And I'm reading this is point six of the BF&M. In such a congregation, each member is responsible and accountable to Christ as Lord. Its two scriptural offices are that of pastor, elder, overseer, so that's one office, and deacon. While both men and women are gifted for service in the church, the office of pastor, elder, overseer, again, one, is limited to men as qualified by Scripture.
Yep.
So that's what it said.
Yeah. That's the doctrinal statement of the Southern Baptist Convention. So that's pretty clear. It's pretty clear. It says men as qualified by Scripture.
But apparently not clear enough.
Apparently, according to, there's a committee that asked for clarity because they base their decisions on who is in friendly cooperation, which is what the SBC says for a church that's in good standing. They base that off of the Constitution more than they do than the BF&M. And so Mike Law put forward an amendment. And Bob, I think you actually have the language of the amendment right in front of you.
Yeah, it's very short and to the point. It says, affirms, appoints, or employs only men as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by Scripture. I'll read it again. Affirms, appoints, or employs only men as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by Scripture.
Yeah. So it's interesting kind of how we got here. In the 80s, there's kind of a question like, hey, it seems like a few churches are kind of doing this.
Right.
And then people were like, well, it's just a few. It's okay. But then
in the SBC,
it's just a few. It's going to be okay. We have a mechanism to deal with it.
Yeah.
you know, but then 20 years earlier, the Methodists said the same thing.
What? I'm sorry. What are you saying, Derek?
I'm saying that
we're going the way of the Methodists.
I'm saying that I want to avoid going the way of the Methodists.
Yeah.
Just clarify.
Yeah. But then, fast forward to today, the primary concern is that when Mike Law went forward to make this amendment, there were something like 1,800 female pastors at churches in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yep.
So there are, some of them are multiple female pastors at the same church. Mm-hmm. And so it's not 1,800 total churches. I don't know what that exact figure is, but that's at least 1,800 deviations from what is clear in Scripture.
Yep.
And so I think 1 Timothy 3 is pretty clear. We've looked a little bit about this passage.
It's very clear. Not pretty clear.
Yeah. Yep. Do you want to share it?
So 1 Timothy 2, Paul gets into the roles of men and women in the church, and he addresses women. And in verse 11, he says, a woman is to learn quietly with full submission. I do not allow a woman to teach or have authority over a man. Instead, she's remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, and then Eve. Adam is not deceived, but the woman was deceived and transgressed. And then you get in chapter 3, which gives the qualifications of elders or pastor overseer. That's all one office. And it's very clear that as Paul gives these qualifications, he's talking about men. One is that he uses the word pronoun he, but also talking about a husband of one wife. And he does not talk about the wife or the woman of one husband. He talks about a husband of one wife. Mm-hmm. Plus, he gets into deacons. And deacons there, he talks about women deacons as we would see it, or mm-hmm. some would see it as the wives of deacons. Mm-hmm. And so if he was not reserving the office of elder, pastor, overseer to men, mm-hmm. it would seem like he would address women also, because he addresses women when it comes to deacons. Mm-hmm. Plus, you see the theme, the storyline of Scripture is men being the head, being leading, particularly then that flows not from the starts with the family, that flows also into the life of the church, and mm-hmm. that consistent storyline. And so mm-hmm. obviously that's the position we hold and mm-hmm. and what the Southern Baptist holds.
Yeah. Yeah. Or so it would seem.
Yeah.
And so I think, so before we get too far down the tracks on this, I was actually able to sit down with Andrew Walker at the Southern Seminary booth and just talk to him a little bit. So right now we're going to share a little bit of that interview. It is a little bit about what we talked about at our Sex, Gender, and the Gospel Conference. So just kind of what he has seen as some developments. He shares some things that are maybe a little concerning to him, but also some things that give him some hope mm-hmm. about where things are going. And then we discuss the law amendment a little bit. And he gives us some reasons why it should be supported, maybe pushes back against some of the arguments against. So here's that interview now. All right. Well, this is Derek Wadley live in majestic Indianapolis, Indiana at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary booth. I'm here with Dr. Andrew Walker. Andrew, it's great to see you again.
Yeah, Derek, it's fun to, we were together in December in Iowa.
That's right.
Very cold, dreary, snowy Iowa day.
That's right.
And it's nice to be with you. It's summer in Indianapolis.
That's right. That's right. And so, yeah, like you said, you were with us for our Sex, Gender, and the Gospel Conference back in December. And the pace at which the LGBT revolution has moved has just been breakneck. It's just been so fast. It's hard to keep up with. So just in this last 6 months, it seems like a lot has changed, not necessarily for the better, but I'm wondering from your perspective, what have you seen happening in the culture and in the world in this arena?
Sure. So a couple of polls that have come out that have really been shocking, but actually not altogether unsurprising. They've come out. The first poll was talking about the decrease in support for same-sex marriage by Americans overall. But then, this is fascinating, a decrease in support for same-sex marriage among Gen Z.
Really?
Yes. This was in the two polls I'm going to talk about, they came from Gallup or Pew,
mm-hmm.
forgetting which in particular,
yes.
But it demonstrated shocking evidence that there seems to be, like, we're now far enough past Obergefell where the new is no longer new, it's mm-hmm. normal,
yeah.
And what was promised to us as just a live and let live, everyone wants the freedom to do what they want in the privacy of their own homes.
Right.
It hasn't done that.
Right.
It hasn't stayed there.
Right.
One of the things I will often say is what began as love is love has ended with, here, kid, take these hormones.
Right.
And I think you understand that on the basis that once you begin to empty out complementarity of the correspondence of male and female sex being necessary for one another,
right,
you emptied out that telos, that nature, that purpose to human interaction,
right,
what you then do is you empty out the purpose of the human person in their own capacity, which then leads to the transgender issue.
Yep.
So at root, and this is like, I think about this as an ethics professor, what LGB and T have in common is that they're both attacking the essential nature of human beings, and then human beings as it relates to their procreative ability.
Right.
Now, I think what I'm getting at here in particular, why Gen Z or why Americans in general might be a little, and let me be very clear, they're still overwhelmingly affirming.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's not as though
it didn't go from like 90 to 2.
Correct. I mean, it has decreased marginally. I think one of the reasons for that is because it hasn't just stayed in this nice zone of equality and liberty.
Right.
It's moved into this domain of conquer and conquest. And, you know, as one of my friends, Eric Erickson, likes to say, you will be made to care.
Right.
And a lot of people might have this attitude of, I want to be kind and polite and tolerant in the public square.
Right.
But I'm tired of having the LGBT stuff crammed down my family's livelihood, right? Literally just on June 1st, incidentally, I didn't intend for this to happen. On June 1st, I went to Target on my home in Louisville.
Yep.
And last year, it was like all out Pride Month at Target.
Right.
Well, then we had all of the crazy stuff happen last year with like the tuck friendly underwear.
Right.
Like you're targeting kids.
Right.
With this gender ideology. Massive blowback culturally. You had the Budweiser situation.
Yep.
You're beginning to have what I call the revenge of the normies.
Right.
Normal moms and dads who are kind of like, you know what? Maybe I can sign up for degree of respect and civil equality in some sense. And I'm not talking amongst Christians even, but just kind of like the broad American consensus. But it didn't stay there.
Right.
It got weird. It got very aggressive.
Right.
So I think that's fascinating. And then literally in the last week, there was a report that came out that said the number of Americans who are beginning to reaffirm that we ought to define gender on the basis of biological sex has increased.
Really?
Yes. So I think to me, what this is emblematic of is, you know, you can only suppress nature for so long. You can only tell people truths. I'm sorry. You can tell people lies for so long until like people are kind of done with it. And nature finds a way to reassert itself. And I think, you know, I think the LGB is probably here for a long time.
Right. Right.
Cultural. And I say that because Americans basically moralize on kind of raw consequentialism and the harm principle. If it doesn't really harm me, I'm okay with it. That's how most Americans think. Right. I disagree with that, but that's how they moralize.
Right.
LGB presents as, at the surface level, harmless.
Right.
Over time, we're going to learn the harmfulness of it.
Right.
As we have more and more kids who are denied the right to a mother and father.
Right.
The trans issue is altogether mentally different because it's more actively in your face and requiring you to affirm things that you don't want to affirm.
Right.
It requires you to, I mean, I said this yesterday to a talk I gave, you know, if you believe in justice, fairness, equality, and you're a progressive and you allow a biological male to obliterate a female in a swimming competition, you actually don't believe in fairness, equality, and liberty and justice.
Right.
You believe in a secular, incoherent paradigm of that.
Right.
And for most people, and let's be very clear, most people aren't ideologues.
Right.
Most people are the normies.
Right.
It actually takes liberalism and ideology to complexify things.
Right.
The beauty of the Christian storyline is the innate simplicity.
I mean, right.
Like, you remember the movie Kindergarten Cop?
Oh, yeah.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Hopefully it's okay to say this on a podcast, too.
Oh, shit.
When the little boy raises his hand and says to Arnold Schwarzenegger, boys have penises,
yeah,
girls have vaginas.
Right.
Like,
that's controversial today.
That's controversial today. And you basically had what was then a five-year-old and a kindergartner, kindergarten class, stand up and state fact.
That's right.
My five-year-old can identify what a man or a woman is much better than a Harvard faculty member.
Right.
And I think that, again, ideology can only go so far until people stop believing in it. I mean, this is why communism fell.
Right.
It fell not only because people were miserable under it, but you had to believe lies.
Right.
About the regime, about the political regime.
Right.
For it to make sense. And people were just like, I don't believe this. This is not delivering on its promises. This is false.
Right.
I'm done.
Right.
And I think, Lord willing, we're beginning to have a little bit of that wash over us as Americans right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like what you're hitting on is that, at least with Obergefell and the way things were going up until then, the LGB community, they were really looking for not necessarily outright affirmation, but just tolerance.
Yes,
just
right.
General tolerance. But then when the transgender revolution has come along, they're looking for all in affirmation.
Yeah.
And to not affirm is to commit, quote, violence against. And so it seems like the language has become so weaponized. And like you said, it's a lie that runs so deep that at this point, it seems like people are just like, I'm not buying into it anymore.
I'm done.
Right.
I mean, I noticed that's like, I want to have all the compassion and tolerance in the world. And for people who are struggling with gender dysphoria, like, I genuinely do have compassion.
Right.
For people with unwanted same-sex attraction.
Right.
They're deserving of nothing but my care and tenderness and mercy as we point them to Christ and to holiness.
Right.
I'm not looking to, like, own the libs in every possible way.
Right.
It's like at the cultural elite level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just done believing in the lies.
Right.
And I think a lot of Americans feel the same way.
Yeah.
And they just want to hear other people say this. Like, hey, I don't believe this anymore.
Right.
You believe this? And they're like, no, not really. Okay, well, let's just make the chorus go a little wider.
Right.
Let's all just say in unison, hey, we don't believe this.
Right. Yeah. And so it seems like there is a fair amount of secular, like, cultural commentators coming out.
Oh, totally.
Pretty, like, Abigail Schreier is one that I've really appreciated.
Totally.
It's like, we disagree on a lot of things fundamentally, but just even her outspokenness has been just refreshing.
Absolutely.
In the secular community. So, yeah, obviously those are things that are hopeful. So, like, what gives you hope? Like, what gives you kind of a gospel hope in the midst of the way things are going?
So, you know me, I'm all about kind of natural law theory and creation order type stuff.
Yeah.
What gives me hope is that you can't run against the grain of the universe with a grain of creation order for very long.
Right.
Without creation order snapping back.
Right.
And so in the long run, I'm actually very optimistic.
Right.
You know, I'm actually going to be working on a book next year where one of the premises of the book is me showing how secular, even progressive data points are reaffirming Christian truths.
Mm-hmm.
So what I always love talking about the ways that, like, progressives end up reverse engineering themselves accidentally to the natural law.
Right.
And they think they've, like, found this amazing, like, truth. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, actually, Christianity has been saying this all along.
Right.
I think what gives me hope is nothing changes for us.
Right.
I'm not having to reevaluate what I think every 5 minutes, like progressives are.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm trying to do is stand on shoulders that have gone before me to pass on a moral tradition, to pass that on to my students and to my children for that to build off of. The true beauty of being a Christian theologian or ethicist is that I'm actually not charged with saying new things.
Right.
I'm charged with communicating the same old truths in new ways.
Right.
For new heresies that are actually old heresies.
Right.
Repackaged in a new way. So the mission here then is to say the Lord who was present at creation is the same Lord who orchestrates redemption.
Right.
And that means you cannot separate out our obedience from Christ's saving lordship from Christ's lordship, but right. how he has made us male and female.
Right.
How he's made us to be in community together, to extol our maleness and our femaleness, to love our children.
Right.
The truths of Christianity are exceptionally ordinary. Mm-hmm. They just sound revolutionary mm-hmm. in this age.
Right.
Just keep teaching.
Great. Yeah, that's great. I look forward to that book. And I think that'll be a huge help to the church, to the culture at large. So it's thank you for the work that you do on that. Along the veins of complementarianism, here at the SBC this year, one of the major issues that's going to be put to the messengers is the law amendment.
Yep.
And I've talked to a handful of people back in Des Moines about the law amendment. They're like, well, what law? What law? It's a little confusing. It's named after a pastor named Mike Law, who put the amendment forward a few years ago. But it's been pretty contentious, it seems, in this run-up. Kind of baffling.
Yeah.
So, and so from your perspective, I'm wondering if you could maybe condense and define the law amendment and maybe what's at stake here and kind of how you would encourage.
Yeah. So, for me, this is actually a really simple issue. Mm-hmm. All the law amendment is seeking to do is to affirm what the Bible affirms.
Mm-hmm.
And it seeks to affirm what our existing confession of faith already affirms,
mm-hmm.
which is that the office of pastor mm-hmm. is for qualified males mm-hmm. only. Now, what that means practically as far as our polity as Southern Baptists is concerned is that what it would mean to be in friendly cooperation mm-hmm. with the Southern Baptist Convention is that all of those churches would then need to appoint, affirm, or hire pastors that are only male.
Right.
So, again, it's not really at all controversial in my book.
Right. At least it should
be. It shouldn't be at all controversial. Now, I think it raises to the level of controversy because some individuals want to say that this is a threat to our traditional denominational structure, mm-hmm. that it makes us more hierarchical mm-hmm. or more Presbyterian, which I simply disagree with that. Every church is autonomous. Every church mm-hmm. can decide how it wants to govern itself. But guess what?
Right.
The Southern Baptist Convention is autonomous. And when the churches come together at its annual convention, they have the autonomous right and the freedom of association to define the parameters of their own cooperation.
Right.
So that means we can define what it means to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
And a church may not cooperate according to our definition, but guess what? That church doesn't have to change its doctrine at all. This is because actually we are protecting autonomy.
Right.
If you want to have female pastors, you can.
Mm-hmm.
We're simply saying that you will then not be able to seat messengers at the convention, which is where the voting power is,
right,
when it comes time to making decisions on behalf of the Southern Baptist Convention,
uh-huh.
because we think that you are outside those grounds of mm-hmm. friendly cooperation.
Right.
So I think that this is necessary because I think we have seen some very imprecise, unclear arguments made by individuals
uh-huh.
who have wanted to inject some ambiguity or decrease the significance of this issue within the convention. And I think that we should pass the law amendment because it is pedagogical and helping us to understand God's creation order, not just in the Bible, but God's creation order as it relates to church offices.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that, you know, the exact point where the culture is attacking the church
yep.
is on the issue of anthropology and on the questions of gender. What a great time right now mm-hmm. for us to simply do the most uncontroversial thing,
right?
Which is to affirm what the Bible affirms,
right?
And to affirm what our confession of faith already affirms,
right?
I understand some churches might be a little bit loosey-goosey on their titling, okay? This is my invitation for you mm-hmm. on your own free will to rethink your titling. I am not seeking to drive any church out of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Right.
I am seeking for as much clarity
mm-hmm.
and obedience to Scripture
mm-hmm.
as we can get as a convention.
Right.
So I would invite critics of the law amendment to have some honest self-assessment and to ask, are we properly titling mm-hmm. within our church?
Right.
Reevaluate, you know, are we operating within a healthy ecclesiology?
Right. Yeah. And that makes sense to me. I think that some of the pushback has been a little bit confusing in that the argument for we're lowering the autonomy of the local church,
which, not true at all.
Which is not true. The slippery slope into mandating certain forms of like eschatology or things like that, it doesn't seem like that's a remote
nothing
possibility.
About eschatology, like pre-mill, post-mill, is in our confession of faith.
Right.
No one's seeking to add it.
Right.
What is in our faith is that only pastors, only males can be pastors.
Right. Exactly. And so...
So it's a simple re-articulation.
Right.
Meant to provide more clarity for the credentials committee.
Right.
To determine when a church is brought forward to the credentials committee to evaluate their hiring practices. Mm-hmm. And I should just say this. This is ultimately going to fall on the messengers. Right. A church could appeal the credentials committee decision.
Mm-hmm.
It then goes to the floor of the committee, the floor of the convention, to either affirm the credentials committee or to overturn the credentials committee's decision. And the convention could overturn the credentials committee.
Right.
You could have a church that is just, they have a female pastor on staff who's about to retire, who's been there for 18 years, and they say, hey, you know, we're never going to give the title pastor to another female, but we're also not going to go ahead and subtract this from this person now.
Right.
If that church got brought up before the credentials committee, the credentials committee could say, well, hypothetically, you've already said that you're not going to repeat this.
Right.
So we don't know if this needs to go to the floor or not. And if it did go to the floor, some messengers might say, hey, this is innocent error.
Right.
This is not like a church that's dogmatically saying, no, like we're going to have female pastors from here until eternity. That's a whole separate set of conversations.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think one of the other pieces of pushback that I've seen is that some people are concerned that the appeals process, should the law amendment pass, is that it gives each of the potentially offending churches 8 minutes to make an appeal on the floor at the next convention. And so if every identified church right now who would be out of cooperation, were they not to retitle or adjust at all, that potentially opens us up to 6.5 hours next year of just listening to appeals, let alone voting and all of that. So what would you say to like that piece of pushback?
I would say that's a fear-mongering tactic. Could it happen potentially? I think that if that were to happen in a Southern Baptist Convention at some point in the future, that would last 1 hour, and then everyone would leave the room, and we would have no longer meetings that day.
Right.
So I think this would be an opportunity for churches to say, hey, I don't want six-hour appeals meetings. Mm-hmm. Let's get clear on our titling as far as pastors are concerned.
Right.
But then secondly, I think it also means, and I say this to people on my right flank, who I love and respect and agree with on this issue, I don't think that means you need to go punitively seeking out for a search and destroy effort every church that disagrees with you.
Right.
This needs to be done with a degree of decorum and respect befitting our polity. This should not be weaponized. And if it is weaponized, I think supporters of the law amendment should express concern about the weaponization of this and call for that to cease.
Right. Yep, that certainly doesn't seem to be the spirit. Is that it is a weapon?
Yeah, and I would use whatever platform I have, if you want to call it a platform, to warn against and to criticize the weaponization of this.
Right, great. Yeah, I know that this particular few days is really busy for you, so I want to respect your time, but I do appreciate you sitting down with
pleasure,
me.
Man.
And yeah, we look forward to continuing to be able to talk to you about this and anything else that might come up. So thank you again.
Absolutely, Derek. Anything I can be of help with, you guys, let me know.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks again to Andrew Walker for sitting down and having that conversation. I think it's really helpful. I really look forward to kind of the friendship that we've been building with him and kind of his willingness to be a resource to us as a church. And the law amendment did not pass. So we had that conversation probably 12 hours before we actually voted on the law amendment. It did not pass. It did not pass. So it was a supermajority. So Bob, our resident parliamentarian, can you explain what
the unofficial parliamentarian of Walnut Creek Church? Yes. Well, it's a high bar, just like a constitutional amendment for our country is a high bar.
Yep.
You know, pass both houses of Congress, 2/3 of the states, that kind of thing. So to have an amendment to the Constitution of the SBC, you have to have a 2/3 vote in 2 consecutive conventions. It passed overwhelmingly last year, I think 88% or something, maybe.
Yeah.
And then, so this year, it while it got a majority, it was 61%,
61.5%, something like that.
That's not two thirds.
That's not.
And so it
big
did,
drop.
Yeah. So it did not pass.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So yeah, there was a big drop, big drop. And so it didn't pass. And so the headlines have been a little bit misleading since it didn't pass. And so there's a number of headlines here. The Associated Press said, Southern Baptists reject a proposal to ban churches with women pastors. New York Times, Southern Baptists reject tighter ban on women on pastoral posts. The Tennessean, Southern Baptists ban on women pastors fails in historic vote. There are headlines like this all over the place that are trying to say that there was this rejection and that it almost sounds like the floodgates are going to open for all of the Southern Baptist churches to start having women as pastors and but that's not really the story. That's not really the story.
It does beg the question though, why was there such a drop in the support from one year to the next though?
Yeah, it does. I think that there's probably a lot of speculating that could be done. It's
Do
a
we
lot
speculate
of
here in this podcast?
No,
that's going to be helpful.
It's not going to be helpful.
Okay. I'm new here. I don't know.
Only if it's helpful.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there are some things out there that are speculated about what may have caused the drop and why, because it only missed by 4%.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge shift. But so I think it's probably better not to speculate because it probably leads into some other things. So I would
don't
just say
be unnecessarily divisive or anything.
But I think the problem with it is that when you look at the headline makes it sound like, you know, like the Washington Post, they were, you know, saying that they narrowly reject a ban on women pastors, or, you know, SBC will not add language banning women pastors to constitution. You're like, well, if you read the BFNM, if you read that, it's very clear already that pastor, elder, overseer is reserved for a man as qualified by scripture. So it's not that the SBC is changing its position, but that's what it sounds like when you look at some of these headlines, that somehow now the Southern Baptists are open to recognizing women as pastors. Mm-hmm. And so that's not what's going on.
Right.
No. And in fact, at the convention this year, there was a clear vote to rule another church not in friendly cooperation with the SBC because they have women pastors. In fact, it was one of the longest standing churches in the SBC.
Legacy church.
Yeah. They called it a legacy church.
Alexandria, Virginia, over 150 years ago.
Yeah. So I think, it's
and
one of those.
And they were supportive of the SBC, it sounds like, too. I mean, with their dollars.
Yeah. And like the vote to rule, to agree. So the Credentials Committee, which is the committee that decides whether or not a church is in friendly cooperation, is the one who said we deem that they are not. And then it goes to the floor for the messengers to vote to either uphold or reject.
Yep.
And the vote for that was overwhelming. It was, and we did this before we voted on the law amendment. It was like 90-10.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was crazy. And the year before, there were two other churches, one being Saddleback Church, which is Rick Warren's, probably the biggest church in the SBC in terms of campuses and number of people that were somehow involved. That was also overwhelming.
Yeah, 9-1.
9-1. Mm-hmm. And so then when it came out that it was like 61%, just, you know, 4 or 5% short of what was needed to pass the law amendment.
Yep.
I honestly was really surprised at that, because there was 90% support for to agree with these churches not being in cooperation. Last year, the first vote, super huge support for it.
Yep.
And then it dropped.
Yep.
So
it seems like there's like 30% of people who voted to get rid of that church, but voted against the law amendment. And so they see it's not the same issue. It's a different issue.
There's a lot of people that push back on it for a variety of different ways. Some who are supportive in principle of it, but not in the practice of
which
how
is actually
it would
a good point. That's not even speculation. That has been stated. If you want to maybe, if you guys can explain that a bit. Or
there was a concern that the point of the law amendment was to become a weapon. It was to become a little bit of a hammer that the Credentials Committee or other churches could come, and then they're just going to start cleaning house. They were going to go and just start wrecking all of these other churches and use it in a pretty aggressive way. But that wasn't the spirit in which it was written. The spirit in which it was written was the Credentials Committee asked for clarity. Mm-hmm. And so this
here's the clarity.
The clarity. Yeah. It's almost like the clarity is that it points to our doctrinal statement, which should inform our constitution. And that was the spirit in which it was.
So I do think there are probably some people, from what it sounds like, that may have voted against it because of their concern about where it would
go. Concern is too much of a top-down approach and what's going to be imposing on the congregations, which that is as much of a core tenet of the SBC as anything.
That's right.
It's autonomy. Local church autonomy.
Yeah.
And,
which is one of the reasons we chose. We appreciate that.
Right. Mm-hmm. We do.
Yep. We don't want to be governed in the sense of like a high church governance.
Yeah. So the big takeaway, I think, for those of you that are listening is that, we are, I think, rightly concerned about the headlines that are out there as it relates to the resolution on IVF and how this constitutional amendment was proposed. Hmm. There is a great amount of discernment that we have to utilize when we read the news, when we listen to the news. And so I've looked at just the whole spectrum of, from far left to far right kind of reviews on this. And I feel like very few of them actually were fair.
It seems like all of them are trying to outrage every side.
Right.
That's their objective, right? Right. Give me some clicks.
I don't even want to click. I want to, the way a lot of it is written is people feel like they can be totally informed by the headline. Mm-hmm. But that's just meant to grab your attention and hopefully get you to dive deeper. But by and large, it has been good to be a part of the Southern Baptist Convention. These meetings have been good. It's been good to meet pastors from other churches, members at other churches, and to build these relationships, especially locally with some of the other SBC churches. So we've been really thankful for that. We'll continue to stay informed and stay updated and keep updating you guys on everything that we need to.
Yep.
And so, that's kind of our goal here and just providing you an update. There is one other update that came up is that every 2 years as a convention, we vote on a convention president. Mm. So there are two presidents in the SBC. There's the executive committee, and that president is hired. It's kind of like the CEO of the business arm of the convention. And so there was a search and a guy named Jeff Orge was hired for that. He was the president of Gateway Seminary. Now he's the president of the executive committee of the SBC. But then we also elected a new convention president. So Bart Barber served the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then we elected a pastor by the name of Clint Presley as a pastor. Where is he a pastor? In North Carolina?
Senior pastor of Hickory Grove Baptist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah, great. So, yep. And so as, I've had some conversations with some other people at the convention as I've listened to him a little bit. And as, we talked at the convention, we felt like we could get behind him and support him. And so that's actually who the group of us that went, that's who we voted for. And there were three elections. I had to go into a runoff because you have to get over 50% of the vote.
Six candidates.
And then weeded it down to four. And then
round two was crazy. There were three all within the 30% range.
Yeah.
Why we love doing this.
That's why we're there. So we just were getting ready for
there was an election and two runoff elections.
That's right. Two runoffs. And so Clint Presley, we'll be praying for him. We'll be kind of watching for whatever guidance he might be able to give the Southern Baptist Convention. And I'm sure that over the next couple of years, we'll have an opportunity to sit down with him and talk with him and share that. So, that's our update from the Southern Baptist Convention. And just thanks again to Andrew Walker for sitting down with us. And Bob, Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
It's good.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Pulpit. Walnut Creek Church exists to glorify God by making authentic disciples of Jesus Christ who love and worship him in all they do. To submit a question to be answered in our next podcast, please visit our website at walnutcreekchurch.org/downtown. If you haven't already, please give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram and sign up for our weekly email updates. And please join us for church on Sunday mornings at 8, 9:15, or 10:45 a.m. at 323 East Locust Street in downtown Des Moines.